did over what I had done before. It was not easy because the most of the material for this study is scattered in many, many libraries. There is no single depository in the country which has anywhere near a complete collection, either of the pamphlet material or newspaper material.
Well, now, let's get down to business for a moment. Dr. Dumont, very early in your book, you mention a figure which was rather startling to me. I believe you state that the slave trade brought out of Africa more than 10 million men and women. Figure, and how and under what circumstances these people perished?
There is no way by which we can accurately determine the loss of life in this infamous trade, which went on for more than two centuries. But the fact that white men from Europe, first the Spanish and the Portuguese and the Dutch and the English, were willing to buy, and for handsome prices, as prices went in those days in Africa, young men and young women on the coast of Africa for the slave trade gave to the larger tribes of Africa a very profitable business.
The slave traders were Africans themselves. And
well, after a while, the early white slave traders went into Africa themselves and hunted slaves. But after a time, it became commercialized, and the very large warlike tribes preyed upon the smaller tribes of Central Africa, usually surrounding a village at night, setting it on fire, and taking out only the very strong young men and young women, who, by the way, have constituted the bulk of all migrations. The sick, the aged, the very young, the brave who fought to the death, all died in this initial holocaust, and then, as they marched to the sea, any slave that fell by the wayside, weary, was dispatched. At the coast, the slave traders bought only the very best, because they feared an outbreak of disease on this terrible trip across the ocean. They kept Africa in a turmoil for over 200 years. And the estimate is that about 1 out of 10 of the slaves were carried out of Africa, of the people were carried out of Africa.
The rest perished.
The rest perished in one way or another, and of course the loss of life in the colonies where the slaves were acclimated was very, very high.
Do you suspect that the kind of tribalism, the warring that went on in Africa at that time was perhaps attributes to the kind of tribalism that even today exists in Africa?
Well, of course, Africa is made up of tribes. Tribal organization is the highest organization you have in Africa today and is at the base of much of our present difficulties there in trying to set up stable national governments. But Africa was always tribal, and the fact that it was, and the fact that it was also not Christian but heathen, made it very vulnerable to the slave traders.
Dr. Dumont, what was the price of a slave at the African coast, roughly, approximately?
I don't know that that can be easily determined, because a great deal of it was barter, in giving them firearms, in giving them rum, liquor, various other things which they wanted. They were not paid for in gold.
Well, what was the profit like?
The early price of slaves in this country was about, I would say, $100 to $150 in present-day terms. When they were brought in fresh from Africa. By 1830, a slave fresh from the African coast was worth about $300 to $400. whereas a prime field hand who had been acclimated or who had been born in the West Indies or in the American South, a prime field hand was worth an average of about $1,000.
So that there was a considerable profit to be made on the slave
enough,
trader's point of view.
Enough profit that they could afford to be caught occasionally and lose their ship and their cargo and perhaps have to pay a heavy fine. There were always men who were willing to undertake the risk of bringing them in, and an average of about 4 to 5 shiploads a year came into the United States, even down to the Civil War.
Now, as to the slave himself, very briefly, I know you devote a good deal of attention to this in your book. How was the slave regarded by his masters? Was he a complete chattel? Did he have any rights? And did it vary significantly from state to state?
I think we have to say that the slave himself had no rights, either positive or substantive. He might have privileges, but his entire life, in a physical sense and in a spiritual sense, was determined by the master and the master alone. And anyone could buy a slave. There were no restrictions upon slave ownership. If you had the money, you could buy. And that meant, of course, that slaves fell into the hands of all kinds of people. And the life of the slave depended and varied from place to place upon the degree to which the master was a kind and generous and Christian gentleman, if such a thing could be possible, in slave ownership.
But there were no injunctions set upon the master, I mean, to...
There were no restraints. Even those laws which were passed for the protection of society and were restraints upon the slave. There were no laws for the protection of the individual slave himself, except to the extent that there were laws which punished, perhaps with a fine, and this varied from state to state, a fine for maliciously killing a slave. But when you remember that no slave could testify in court in any case involving a white man, and no white man would willingly kill a slave or even viciously punish a slave in the presence of another white man, then the law simply did not exist and the courts did not exist for the protection of the slave. And the masters were permitted by the law, and they were permitted by public opinion, to kill any slave who raised his hand against him, even in, if it were done in the terrible pain of severe punishment, or if they ran away, or if they were trying to defend their mates against assaults by white men. In any of these cases, the white man had the right to kill them, and did kill them.
Turning now to the major subject of your book, what were the origins of the anti-slavery movement in America? Who were the first groups to be seized by revulsion at this institution?
Well, I suppose the African, as soon as the African slave trade began, men began to oppose it. We have very early records in this country of work by the Quakers. The Quakers were the first to oppose it as a group, but only within their own society.
They did not then crusade for...
Not in the early years. The two men who were most active in this work were John Woolman and Anthony Benezet. John Woolman was a tailor in New Jersey. and his family owned slaves. Many of these Quakers were very wealthy slaveholders, had been so in Barbados and other West Indian colonies. Benezet was a schoolmaster in Philadelphia. Now, Woolman went about among the Quakers, visiting in their homes, insisting always on paying for his meals and his lodging if they kept slaves, but sitting down quietly, as Quakers do, and discussing with them the sin of slavery. Benezet established schools for the Negroes, the freed Negroes, in Philadelphia, and this work was also carried on in New York. And the great Negro leaders of the 1820s, 30s, and 40s were the products of these early schools established just before the Revolution by the men like Benezet and Woolman. These were the two great leaders. Then the organized anti-slavery movement began just after the Revolution in 1790, when societies were founded in all of the middle states for the improvement of the condition of the Negro and for emancipation. And these societies were the ones which carried through gradual emancipation in states like New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey in the days just following the close of the Revolutionary War. And the last state to emancipate, of course, was New Jersey in 1804. There was strong anti-slavery sentiment in Virginia, but it never was strong enough to rid the state of slavery. Now, after the Quakers, of course, then you had men like Benjamin Rush, who was a Presbyterian. And I suppose as soon as the organized movement really developed, more anti-slavery people were Presbyterians and worked in and through Presbyterian church organizations than of any other denomination.
I had always thought that Presbyterianism was somehow associated with slavery, in the South at least.
Well, it is true that there were many Presbyterian ministers in the South who supported slavery, but that was because the liberal Presbyterian ministers were driven out of the South, and many, very many of them came from South Carolina, from other parts of the South, up into Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois before 1830. There was no organized opposition to slavery in the southern states, where the slaveholders themselves had control, and they had control everywhere by 1830. And then a great wall of silence settled upon the South, as much as exists behind the Iron Curtain. Anyone who spoke against slavery, whether it was in a church, whether it was a judge in the court, a man in the legislature, or a private citizen, was in trouble and in deep trouble. And so everyone remained silent, and the entire South just settled back in defense of perpetual slavery. And they tried to keep all anti-slavery literature out by excluding it from the mails. And there was a long period of time existing down to the Civil War when the postmasters of the United States government in the southern states had to abide by the laws of the state and destroy, and in any case not deliver, any anti-slavery literature.
You mean pamphlets?
Pamphlets, or anything else which could be determined to be anti-slavery literature without opening first-class mail or anything of that sort.
Now, so far, in speaking of anti-slavery, you've mostly spoke of those people who opposed it from a religious point of view. Did the anti-slavery movement also have its roots in the British and French traditions of egalitarianism that were developing in the 19th century in Europe?
Unquestionably so, and there was a very close connection between the anti-slavery people in the United States the anti-slavery people in Great Britain. For instance, Benezet's writings were widely distributed in England and on the continent. He was originally a Huguenot who had come over to this country. And Sharp in Great Britain, who argued the Somerset case, the decision of which freed all the slaves in Great Britain in 1774. Sharp was a very close correspondent with Benezet. You can find a case like that which indicates that the British movement sprang from the American movement, but you can find many cases later where British pamphlets, British literature, was widely distributed in the United States, and there was a close personal correspondence between the leaders in the two countries.
What about a man like Tom Paine? Was he fairly active in the anti-slavery movement?
Not as such, but only as a part of his great work. And I have some quotations from Paine in the book. He spoke very strongly against slavery, of course. It just didn't jibe with his philosophy of human rights. I don't think any great leader of the revolutionary period, and I'm speaking now of men like Otis or Jefferson or Mason or Wilson, I don't think any great leader who believed in the philosophy, the doctrine stated in the Declaration of Independence and other basic documents of this country ever did or possibly could have endorsed slavery. But then I would go even farther and say that no really, truly great man ever would have permitted his name to be used in defense of human bondage. And I don't believe it's possible to find any such person.
Now, you spoke before of a great wall of silence descending over the South. Why were the slaveholders so reluctant to give up their chattel? Was slavery an economically viable institution?
No, I think you can get into trouble if you try to analyze slavery from the standpoint of economic determinism. Wherever slavery went, it went first of all as an economic institution because people wanted labor in America and wealth was to be had here. If you could bring labor and land together, African slaves were brought here. But as soon as it became an economic institution in that sense, it became a social system. And slaveholders became a social aristocracy. And as soon as it became an economic and social system, it became a system of racial adjustment. And this was because the slaveholders in the colonies wanted to keep their slaves. And international law, if you can use that term at that time, certainly world opinion, was opposed to enslaving Christians. And just as soon as the slave traders moved in to bring slaves to America, the missionaries moved in to convert them and give them their freedom. And so all colonial legislatures, or assemblies as they were then called, passed laws which changed the basis of slavery from heathenism to race. And these laws said anyone of African descent was presumed to be a slave, whether Christian or not. Now, the thing which made slavery perpetual and permanent, I am convinced in my own mind, was the clause in the Constitution of the United States, which counted 3/5 of the slaves in apportioning representation in the House of Representatives. Because that gave to the southern slave states from 17 to 25 additional members of the House of Representatives, and additional votes in the Electoral College, and additional votes in each of the national political conventions.
And this tremendous political leverage, which they still have even to this day, as a result.
Yes, it gave it to them because they held other men in bondage, and in proportion as they held other men in bondage. And there never was a law passed by Congress, down to the Civil War, in support of slavery, or extending slavery, and I'm talking about laws like the Missouri Compromise, the Compromise of 1850, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, never a single law passed that could have been passed except for these votes which these men in the South had because they held slaves. And slavery could have been abolished. It never could have been extended to the territories at all if it hadn't been that the slave power had these extra votes. Now, the tragic thing is that when we fought the Civil War and gave the slaves their freedom, then all of the Negroes, instead of three-fifths, were counted. And the number to which they were not entitled on the basis of their white population immediately jumped from 25 to 35. So that from that time to this, to whatever degree, and I'm emphasizing this, to whatever degree the Southern whites prevented the Negroes from voting and from participating in public affairs, the South has had this extra tremendous political power. And they still have it today wherever they keep the Negroes from voting. And, of course, in the lower South, any fool knows that they don't vote. At least they don't freely participate in public affairs anywhere. And that means that these reactionary Southerners who are supporting segregation have this tremendous political power in the political parties and in Congress and in the Electoral College. This is a severe handicap to men who are trying to liberalize or even rationalize our political system.
So that while emancipation was intended to give the Negro his franchise, it has worked somewhat in the opposite direction in certain respects.
Well, the tragic thing is, of course, that we called the slaves in and told them they were free to go where they pleased. We call this emancipation. But slavery was something far more than retaining a man in physical confinement and telling him what he had to do. Because slavery, in a real sense, was the doctrine of biological inequality and racial inferiority.
Could it have been possible, was it possible, or were there any instances, could a white man have been a slave?
Oh, yes. I don't think there was any reason to suppose that he couldn't have been, because we carried the principle of color as presumptive of slavery even into the United States courts. And there were hundreds of thousands of people in the North who were darker skinned than hundreds of thousands of slaves in the South. And if a kidnapper came into the North and seized a person of a dark skin and took him before a justice of peace and said, "This is my slave, he ran away from Alabama," there was nothing under God's heaven to protect that person. Because it wasn't fugitive slaves that were taken before the courts by the men trying to reclaim alleged fugitives. It was persons who were being taken before the courts to determine whether or not they had been slaves. And none of the provisions of due process of law existed in these cases to protect free persons.
Now, I noticed that one portion of your work is a pretty large bibliography of the literature of anti-slavery. Dr. Dumont, very often the literature of causes is not remarkable for its eloquence 100 years later. Is this true of the literature of anti-slavery? Are there any great works of American literature to be found in the literature of anti-slavery? Things that you have become aware of that are not generally known by the American public?
Yes, there is an enormous amount of what I would call fine literature in this anti-slavery material. Because, after all, the intellect moves from the heart. And these men were devoting their lives, dedicating their lives to the cause of human freedom. And some of their oratory, not alone by Wendell Phillips, but by some men who are almost unknown in history, such as Charles Stuart of New York, who deserved a better fate because he was the founder of the Republican Party, the origins of the Republican Party. And particularly the writings of Theodore Weld belong among our finest literature, but they have simply been neglected through all the years because historians have paid very little attention.
Would these be, for the most part, polemics and essays of various kinds?
Their essays and their speeches. Wendell Phillips wrote very little, but he was a magnificent orator. Theodore Weld never permitted any of his speeches to be published, and I have only meager notes from his speeches. But he was unquestionably one of the most powerful orators this country has ever seen. And his speeches, if we had them, would be magnificent. His writings, particularly his one book, American Slavery as It is just phenomenal. You can sit down and enjoy it any time, no matter how tired you are.
One final question, Dr. Dumont. Why do you refer to the movement you've studied as anti-slavery rather than abolition, which seems to be a common term also?
Well, for two or three reasons, but particularly because abolition in among these revisionist or so-called revisionist historians has come to have a mean connotation. And it's undeserved. But primarily because men who were opposed to slavery had various objectives. There were a few really honest anti-slavery men who were colonizationists and believed it was the thing that we ought to do to send the Negroes to Africa or to Haiti. The bulk of them did not believe so. The true test of an anti-slavery man was whether he was willing to free the slaves, keep them here in the country where they were born and where a good case can be made out to prove that they were citizens, and improve them intellectually and morally as citizens of the United States. It was the acid test of democracy. And that is why I've tried to use this term, which didn't have any mean or preconceived connotation in the minds of people.
Thank you very much, Professor Dwight Lowe Dumont.
In that recorded interview, Dick Ellman spoke with Professor Dwight Lowell Dumont, whose book, The Anti-Slavery Movement in America, will be published by the University of Michigan Press.